Welcome to the Blockchain Life with your host, Wall Street Journal and USA Today's best-selling author, Carrie Oberbrunner. In each episode, we explore relevant topics that help you keep your world connected and protected. Thanks for joining the conversation today. Let's begin.
The world has changed. Are you still trying to reach people the same way? If you are, you're like most people. And unfortunately, you're going to be left behind. This is why at the Igniting Souls Conference 2022, we are taking an absolute deep dive and showing authors, entrepreneurs, and influencers how to leverage the new internet to grow their book, brand, and business. All the information is at ignitingsoulsconference.com. Get your ticket today because there are limited seats. And right now, it's the super early bird. Hope to see you there. Hey folks, I am here with a really cool guy. I already like his picture in the back. We're going to talk about it in a moment. But this is Omid Malakhan. How are you doing today, my friend?
I'm good. Thank you for having me here. Excited for the conversation.
Well, listen, I really filter the guests, and we have a lot of people who actually want to get on the show. But I saw your bio. I saw what you were doing. I said, we need Omid on. Tell us what you do, what your experience is with blockchain, how you got into this whole conversation, and tell us about the picture on the back.
Yeah. So I am an adjunct professor at Columbia Business School, where I teach about blockchain and crypto. Wow. I just published my second book on the topic called Rearchitecting Trust. I have been working in the crypto industry for about 5 years now, other than being an author and a professor. I also work as a consultant. My forte is to sort of sit between the people and companies from the traditional world who have some kind of interest in crypto, and then those who are actually trying to build it. Sometimes I feel like I play the role of an interpreter, because you have two groups of people who, despite what some of them might think, really actually need each other, but they don't necessarily speak the same language.
That makes sense.
Yeah. So, for example, I did a 3.5 year stint as a consultant for the VC arm of a big bank. And that was a very interesting experience, because so much of crypto does boil down to how it might impact the existing financial infrastructure. But as I actually lay out in the new book, that will not be done without first understanding the existing financial infrastructure. And then second, really building on top of it. Wow. My overall thesis is that eventually we're going to see a convergence of these two worlds.
Okay.
And that actually comes from how I originally got into crypto, which goes back almost 9 years now. It was back in the late 2013, early 2014 period. I originally have a financial services background. I worked on Wall Street. I was a trader and had various other roles. But then by that time, I was completely out of finance doing other things, but I had a friend who sort of forced me to learn about Bitcoin. Particularly, she forced me to figure out how to get her some. And I had no interest. I probably had a lot of the same suspicions that many people do today. Yeah. And I had no idea what I was doing. It was, and still is, unbelievably complicated and confusing. But I had to do it because I had to help my friend. And when I did that first on-chain transaction, I was just moving some Bitcoins to a wallet on my computer. And I was sort of mesmerized by just how different it was from any other kind of financial activity that I had done before. And I had this hunch that eventually this technology would be used to change everything. Including banking and finance, but you know, as we're seeing, like almost on a daily basis now, all sorts of new interesting applications. All that said, I had a hunch, and I knew nothing about anything. I do not have a technical background.
Okay.
So everything that I know and teach now about things like cryptography or distributed systems, I had to go and learn from scratch, which was painful, but it helped me become this role or this person that I am today, which is that I am often in a position where I am speaking to other non-technical people who need to understand enough of the technical to make a decision. However, what they don't want is somebody dumping a bunch of complicated buzzwords on them.
Yes. Well, the moment you mentioned your book, I'm a publisher, so I quick jumped over to Amazon. And your book comes out July 12th?
Yeah.
Something like that?
Yeah.
And I love it. I mean, James Altucher, how do you say it? Is it Altucher?
Altucher.
Altucher. I've heard of him. He endorses you. Lewis Cohen. That's interesting. I know a Cohen, but it might be different. But I look at this book. It's positioned really well. I want to read the subtitle because it just makes a ton of sense. It says, "The Curse of History and the Crypto Cure for Money, Markets, and Platforms." So what does that mean? Tell us about that.
So as the title implies, this is really a book about trust. The first book that I wrote was this beginner's guide to Bitcoin and blockchain, and like a very simple, what is it? How does it work for non-technical and non-ideological people, which happen to be most people.
Yes.
With this book, I really wanted to get down to almost like a philosophical level of what is it about this technology and this industry that I believe is useful. And it really is best understood through this lens of trust, which is sort of like the most important thing that nobody ever thinks about until something goes wrong. And then it becomes the only thing we think about.
Interesting.
And so much of our existing world is built around the different trust frameworks that we have for things money, banking, even social media.
Yes.
I think a lot of your listeners would agree that there's evidence a lot of these trust frameworks are breaking down. There's a lot of inflation in fiat currencies. Many people are not happy with banking and financial services. I mean, the mistrust in social media is almost, it's funny.
It's like fake news, right? Yeah.
Yeah, fake news. Even the debate between Elon Musk and Twitter about what percentage of the users are fake or bots. It's a funny thing where everybody's like, yeah, I know there's something fishy going on here. I just don't know what.
Wow.
So what I tried to explain with the book is what is fishy and why. And a lot of it has to do with so much of our society is architected in a way that goes back to before there was an internet.
Okay.
Right. If you think about the banking industry, it really architecturally has not changed much in decades. Even with things like fintechs, right? Fintechs look modern because they're digital and they use the cloud and AI and use a mobile app. You're no longer walking into a bank branch to do something. But the core way that that industry serves clients and moves money around has not changed. And with trust in particular, technology aside, there's also this historic cyclicality to it. Because on the one hand, if you and I find a way to trust each other, then it serves us both. We're both better off. And this dynamic explains so much of how humanity works, right? Like, why do we have money? Money is really just a way to get a whole bunch of people to trust each other, to do commerce specifically. The banking industry is an industry of trust. If you think about the physical architecture of a bank, you know, the big columns and the vault. If you think about the names, I mean, some of these banks actually have the word trust in
trust.
Them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. Never thought of that.
And even when you use social media, you sort of trust someone with your data and you trust them to show you information that is at least credible and not designed to manipulate you. in the book, I get into why that's not working today. But the other funny thing about trust is that the cyclicality comes from the fact that the more established a trust framework becomes, okay, then the easier it becomes for somebody to take advantage of it. So with money, the more trusted a currency becomes, then the more the issuer is tempted to print more of it. Mm. Because in the beginning, printing money is all upside, right? Like you get to fund the government or a war or something. And because people trust your currency, they're not going to stop using it. However, as time goes on and that trust erodes, then you get something like inflation. Inflation is just people using trust in a currency. We have a mild version of it now in many countries, but there are severe versions of it in some countries, which I get into the book. With the banking system, too much trust led to something like the 2008 financial crisis.
Right.
With Facebook, too much trust leads to everything that we've now learned about how they look the other way with things like fake news and bots and manipulated. You know, like it's taken whistleblowers to prove something that everybody has suspected. And this is the curse of history. No, none of these, the Federal Reserve and Lehman Brothers and Facebook did not set out to do harm. We all remember when Google's motto used to be, don't be evil.
Is that what it used to be?
Yeah. And there was a time where that was actually what they practiced. It wasn't just like, you know, now in some ways it's a punchline, because if you look at some of the things that they do in places like YouTube or with the search results just to increase advertising revenues, Google is the biggest ad company in the world. Interestingly enough, if you read the original paper published by Larry Page and Sergey Brin, they have a whole section in the appendix about how advertising is a bad model for search.
Interesting.
And this is, to me, the sort of the perfect example of this curse of history, which is that they meant that. And in the paper, they actually talk about how at that point in time, if you did a Google search for a cell phone, you wouldn't see ads for cell phones. You would see, I think the first link back then was something about the dangers of texting while driving. So useful information. You do a Google search for cell phone now, and you're going to get a whole bunch of ads, some of which are actually for phones like the Pixel that Google itself makes.
Wow.
And they didn't set out to necessarily go down that path. It's just they had a very successful search engine, but at some point somebody said, wait, how do we make money from this? And that's the same as banks, that even something like Madoff. Like, I don't think Bernie Madoff did not set out to run a massive global Ponzi scheme. I worked in finance at the time. He had this stellar reputation for being a very trustworthy individual in many ways. But we now understand that that reputation is what allowed his Ponzi scheme to go on for so long and to get as big as it did, because people trusted him. If he had been a nobody, I think more people would have been skeptical of what he was selling and say, wait a minute, how is this possible? Let me look into it. So that's the curse of history.
So trust. I read a book on blockchain. Maybe you've heard of it. I like yours, by the way. It sounds very exciting. I'm going to have to get it. The book about a few years ago, I think it was called The Truth Machine.
Yes.
Not The Trust Machine, but The Truth Machine. But it was about how blockchain essentially, in its very nature, promotes truth because of decentralization, global ledgers, proof of stake, proof of work. You're saying, not that your book is called The Trust Machine, but you're really playing that card of trust. And then isn't that what blockchain is called? A trustless. Can you help my listeners? Some of them may be very new to Web3. Why is it called trustless?
Great question. First of all, welcome to anybody who's new. If you are confused about all of this, then welcome to the club. I joke in the first class of the semester with my students that I've spent 9 years being confused about crypto, so they don't have to be. But I'm still confused. I'm just confused about some of the more advanced, cutting edge applications than I used to be.
I get you.
But trustless is a counterintuitive term that sort of means the opposite of what it implies. So any solution that is trustless is one where you don't have to trust anyone or anything, but you can trust the outcome.
Interesting.
Okay. So specifically, this is an oversimplification, but using a calculator is trustless.
Let me hit that. Let me hit that. Yeah, go for it.
No, if you use a calculator a million times and do a calculation, you can trust that it will always give you the same number. Mm. Investing in fund managers named Bernie is not trustless. You trust Bernie to not be a Ponzi scheme, which may or may not be the case. Mm-hmm. And most of our existing systems are not trustless. They are what we call trusted. So mm-hmm. we trust the Federal Reserve to contain inflation. We trust a bank to not do risky things with our deposits and eventually blow up.
So it's something that we have to like deposit trust in the system for it to work. And you're saying that a trustless doesn't require.
Right. Almost everything that I listed requires some kind of a leap of faith. And there are many infrastructures in place to maintain that. So for example, banking is highly regulated, and those regulations are mostly designed to preserve trust. But now we're trusting the regulators to do a good job. What's interesting when you get into Bitcoin and blockchain and Web3 is that if we take the simple example of Bitcoin, nobody trusts anybody. If I'm sending you some Bitcoins, you don't have to trust me. Neither of us has to trust the miners. Wow. Validate transactions, the nodes, those are people who just keep a copy of the ledger. And yet we can trust the outcome. That's why it's called trustless. And mind you, not everything in crypto is trustless. For example, if you use a centralized exchange, like the biggest ones are Binance and Coinbase, FTX, those are trusted entities. They are built on the traditional model because you're trusting them. For example, if they say, well, I have one Bitcoin here and I'm holding it for you, you trust them that they actually do. That's different than if you have your own wallet and you have the cryptographic key that can unlock that wallet. And then that wallet has a balance of one Bitcoin. That is trustless. There's nobody that can get in between you and your one Bitcoin. And what's happening now in Web3 is that all sorts of entrepreneurs and developers are asking a question of what else can we apply this money to? Bitcoin solved a relatively limited use case. Okay. But what we're now seeing, particularly on some of the newer blockchains like Ethereum, is people trying to apply this model to things like banking, to borrowing and lending, to things like digital art and collectibles, and potentially even things like decentralized social media.
Interesting. When you say decentralized social media, are you talking about media that is validated, almost like if I issue a post or a tweet, that it will be issued with a NFT that could be tracked back? So, hey, this is really Carrie who said it.
Yes, that would be ownership of the content, and the traceability of the content would be one feature. Other features would be transparency. One of the key trust-building mechanisms in society, actually, is transparency. Right? We always try to inject it where we think that trust is important, like, for example, in a good legal system. A good legal system is a very transparent legal system. And part of the problem with what we call Web2 social, or social media as designed today, is that we have no idea what goes on under the hood. What are the algorithms and rules that determine, for example, what content I see versus what content you see?
Yes.
Why is it that some things go viral and get a lot of hits and likes and followers and other things don't?
Yes.
and this is the ongoing battle between Elon Musk and Twitter. And if we had Web3 social, which, by the way, there are multiple teams trying to build this now. It's still early. I don't think any of
Discord, not really. Discord
no,
more of like a community.
Yeah, Discord's more of like a community. I'm talking about literally, like, imagine if we could replicate Twitter, but in a way that, as you said, everything is an NFT. So there's traceability and ownership. There's full transparency. There's still always going to have to be rules and algorithms that determine what content gets displayed to whom when, but then we know how they work. And then the third component of decentralized social media would be community ownership as opposed to corporate ownership.
Yes.
Which is another one of the ideas I try to hash out in the book. And not that I have anything against corporations. So I think even in like a crypto-centric future, we're still going to need corporations. But part of the problem with the current Web2 design for platforms, any platform really, it could be Facebook, it could be Twitter, YouTube, or even Uber, is that you have one group who are the owners. Those are the shareholders.
Yeah.
Then you have another group who are the users. That's me and you, or Uber drivers, or, you know, Instagram influencers, etc. And in the long run, the shareholders could only benefit at the expense of the users. So Uber is a perfect example of this because it's never made money. And the only way Uber can make money is by either charging riders more or paying drivers less. That's it. And this, if you actually tune into an Uber quarterly report, this take rate is all they talk about. With something like Twitter or Facebook, these are advertising companies. And to maximize ad revenues for shareholders, they need to maximize engagement by people like you and me. They need to hook our attention and hold it for as long as possible. And it turns out the best way to do that is by allowing a lot of provocative, outrageous, angry, sometimes offensive content. So there is this inherent conflict of interest in Web 2 between the owners and the users.
Wow.
What's interesting in Web 3 is that you can collapse these two categories into one. And a oversimplified example of this is, think about Bitcoin, right? Bitcoin is a network, a platform, a payment system, whatever you want to call it. It moves value from point A to point B, like Visa and MasterCard do, or the banking system does. But what's interesting about Bitcoin is that there are no shareholders. There are clearly network effects there, right? It's clearly like a valuable network. If you look at how many users it has, the global brand recognition, like there's some value there, but the only way to capture that value is to own a Bitcoin.
Wow.
And theoretically, this model could be applied to social media in a way that the most active content creators and users will also be the biggest owners.
Wow. Mm. I like what you're saying, though, because it makes a ton of sense. We, you know, to summarize, I'm a publisher, so I view it as, hey, we live in the attention economy. And before people want you to pay for a product or service, they try to get you to pay for your attention. And you, like you said, whether it was a social dilemma that came out that said, hey, your feed, Omid, is different than Carrie's feed, therefore truth is already compromised. But let's put on Carrie's feed things that are either he's gonna love or hate. Not just neutral, but like let's get him back because he loves it, or just really emotionally charged. So I've never heard it like that. That's really good how you shared that. That it almost distrusts the system. Back to your book.
Yeah, and it's funny. Like I ask people all the time, like, do you actually trust Facebook the company or Twitter the company? And the answer is almost universally no. But then what's the alternative? Because if someone comes up with a new version of Twitter, but it has the same architecture as Twitter and the same business model as Twitter, then eventually we'll have the same problems as Twitter, because it's not the management team or the engineers at Twitter who are evil. Profit model. Right. It's the profit model and this bad incentive structure, where Twitter's interest is, when it comes to things like what Elon Musk is concerned, fake users and bots, right? All else being equal, Twitter would like for there to be a lot of those, because then they can go to advertisers and say, look, we got a gazillion users or a gazillion tweets happened today. My interest and your interest is that there be none of those.
Wow.
So if you theoretically, I keep saying theoretically because I actually have good friends, very, very smart people who've been trying to crack this model using blockchain and decentralization, and they haven't gotten there yet.
Okay.
But theoretically, if we all own Twitter, then we would make very different decisions. We might still have ads. We might still monetize. But there's a point at which we're going to be like, hey, I don't care if I'm going to make less money. There's a point at which I feel like we're degrading the trust in this platform.
Mm.
So we're going to stop doing some of the more radical things, or we're going to be a lot more stringent on preventing fake accounts and bots. Mm-hmm. And we're going to be okay to do that because, by the way, we also own this thing. So maybe a more trustworthy, sustainable Twitter is actually more valuable to us shareholders down the line.
And that could be owned or run by a DAO. Decentralized Autonomous Organization for the new listeners. So that could be the owned by the people, essentially.
That's right. Wow. And there are all of the solutions that people are trying to build are owned and operated by DAOs. But there too, it's very early days. Like even the definition of a DAO, so you explain it stands for Decentralized Autonomous Organization. What that actually means varies from DAO to DAO. DAOs are sort of like the blockchain or decentralized equivalent of a corporation. So whereas a corporation derives legitimacy from the state, you go file articles of incorporation. A DAO drives legitimacy from the blockchain. Whereas a corporation keeps its assets, like its cash in a bank, the DAO, you have tokens on the blockchain. DAOs often use smart contracts and code to do things like move value around. They will put important decisions up for a vote with the token holders. However, many, many ifs, you know, and many questions, right? Like DAO governance is actually a fascinating area of exploration right now.
Yeah.
Because let's continue with our analogy, right? We have our Twitter DAO. Decentralized Twitter DAO. And some decisions have to be made. There was this vision originally with DAOs that everyone would vote on everything and it would be like one token, one vote.
Utopia type, yeah, vision.
Exactly. Yeah. But crypto keeps learning the lessons of history. And there's a couple of problems with the model that I just described. One, nobody wants to vote.
Mm.
It's like we know this from how democracy works. And you can imagine if you got a DAO and there's all these decisions that have to be made. In centralized Twitter, the CEO makes that decision, or the COO, or the board.
Yeah.
But with a DAO, the utopia that we'll all, every user, that's just not going to work. Second problem, one token, one vote has its downsides too. Because you might have like, you know, there have been DAOs where it turns out that one person owns a lot of the tokens and they're the only people who show up to vote.
Okay.
So it's like a democracy, but not a very effective one.
Yes.
So all of this is just such a fascinating area of exploration.
Yeah.
And I think in time, people will come up with better token models, better governance models, better DAOs. And also that the lessons learned there will actually start to impact the rest of the economy. Things like actual elections in a democracy.
Yes.
Or even like anybody who's ever lived in a co-op, trying to figure out how a co-op board is elected and operates. That is a massive governance problem.
Yes. I love this. This is amazing, folks. You gotta check out this book. I'm hooked. Quick question, because I'm a publisher, I gotta ask. Are you coming out with the audiobook?
Yes.
Yes. All right. Awesome. I think you're going to blow it up then. And where can we find out more about you?
So other than just searching for Rearchitecting Trust on Amazon and getting the book, I have a Medium blog. So if you just search for Omid Malakhan Medium, where I will post some of the more contemporary thoughts that I have. You know, the challenge of writing a book on such a cutting edge topic is that new things happen all the time.
Yep.
So those I put on Medium. And then otherwise, in my personal website, omidmalakhan.com, is where I post where I will, sometimes I will publish an essay in the mainstream media, or I'll be quoted in the media, and awesome podcast interviews like this.
I love it. I love it. Great picture, great website. Check out Omid's page, his social, and tell us again. You said you teach at a school. You're a professor.
I'm an adjunct professor at Columbia Business School.
I love it. I love it. Well, listen, man, I am thrilled that we were able to chat. You got my brain going about, I love the history standpoint, because that, I think you're onto something. The curse of history. You're basically saying, look, we didn't arrive here by out of the sky. There's a pattern going on. And unless Web3 thinks differently, we're going to fall into the same struggles. Is that kind of the thought?
Exactly. While also building on top of the lessons of history.
Okay.
So I think the one other thing that you'll find unique about my book is that there's actually more content in there about how the world works today and why it came to be that way than there is about crypto. Because I think if you say, I am going to disrupt banking, then you need to really understand the history of banking.
Yes. That's so good. Listen, my friend, I had a blast today. I really appreciate this. And I know we're going to be in touch in the future. We'll blow this up, this interview, and keep doing amazing work.
Thank you for having me. I enjoyed the conversation.
All right. We'll see you. Take care.
Thanks for listening to Blockchain Life. We hope today's conversation ignited your soul and inspired your mind. Post your comments in a podcast review on iTunes or your platform of choice. We read every single review because your thoughts matter to us. Please share this episode with a friend. We look forward to seeing you again on the next episode.